we've had a lot of calls and some basic questions, but we've actually only received two applications.
An energy efficiency loan program for schools goes unused. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state intervenes in a controversial tribal jurisdiction case.
I continue to be shocked that they could represent the interests of a man who they convicted for attempted murder.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Every year, the state spends $100 million on school district utility bills. Back in 2010, the legislature established a loan program to help bring those costs down. The loans were supposed to cover energy upgrades to public buildings, and they would be paid back with the money saved on heating fuel. But even though rising energy costs continue to be a problem for districts, APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that schools haven't used the funds as a fix.
The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is in charge of managing what they call the Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund. They can issue up to $250 million in loans to school districts, boroughs, and the university system. Given what a big problem energy costs are across the state, you might expect Eric Havelock, who administers the program, to be swamped with applications. You would be wrong.
We've had a lot of calls and some basic questions, but we've actually only received two applications.
Those came from the cities of Kenai and Seward, and neither one of them ended up going through with the loan. Meanwhile, there's been no shortage of private property owners turning to AHFC for financing. The lack of public customers has been surprising to CEO Brian Butcher.
Okay, we have a program. We feel like it's set up to work. We know that reducing energy costs by 15 to 30% is going to be beneficial for any community. Why isn't it happening?
Back before he was named head of AHFC this year, Butcher handled government relations for the corporation and helped shuttle the loan program through the legislature. It was a tough fight, involving a veto from then-Governor Sarah Palin. The enabling legislation also got swallowed into another bill with some major changes. In the end, lawmakers agreed to just give AHFC the authority to bond for $250 million as soon as they got loan applications in. But because no loans have been made, no bonds have been issued so far. Butcher says it's not for lack of trying. He says AHFC has done outreach and they've been looking at why school districts aren't biting.
We can't obviously do this program alone. We can set the program up and we can laud the benefits of it, but it takes a lot of different state and municipal agencies working together.
Bruce Johnson is the head of the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and he says that Butcher is right, and it's not unfamiliarity with the program that's keeping districts from applying. It's a question of who can make long-term commitments about a school district's budget.
I think that everybody was aware that this was available, but I think we looked at who owns the facilities in the state of Alaska. The two entities are, you know, local municipalities where they have a tax base, and are either a borough, you know, organized borough or city, and the state owns the rest.
Because school districts only budget 1 year out, committing to a 5, 10, or 15-year loan isn't something they can do easily. The decision to get an energy efficiency loan is really up to the state and local governments that own the school buildings. Johnson says there's another big reason AHFC hasn't seen any takers for their loans. In the past, school districts have had success getting state grants to cover energy upgrades. It's money they don't have to pay back or worry about affecting their budget a decade out. But with oil revenues declining and Governor Sean Parnell implementing a cap on general fund spending, Johnson thinks there may be more interest from districts in the loan program.
The new era in Alaska this next decade is going to be challenging financially, and it's going to impact public education, and as a result, we want dollars in the classroom.
Better that, he thinks, than paying the heat. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Next month marks a year since the launch of the National Science Foundation's new Arctic research vessel, Sikuliak. The 261-foot ice-class ship, to be operated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks, remains at dock at a shipyard in Marinette, Wisconsin. UAF project principal investigator Terry Whitledge is closely tracking work on the vessel.
We're a little behind schedule, but, you know, these things are very hard to predict. It's a pretty complex set of systems that have to go together to make everything work. You know, we had hoped originally, way back 3 years ago, that we'd have everything completed by July. Well, we found a few things that we needed to fix or to alter. And so we're running maybe 2 to 3 months behind what we had anticipated.
The Sikuliak was originally scheduled to arrive at its home port of Seward in January, but will now likely deploy directly to research next spring. Whitledge says ongoing fixes, including an updated lubrication system for the propulsion drives, are not adding to the cost of the ship. He says about $145 million of a nearly $200 million budget has been spent.
Of course, you always want some money for as contingency, we call it, in case there is a problem. But right now, we expect it to come in maybe slightly under budget.
Whitledge cautions that a lot of the remaining dollars are allocated to management, transportation, and testing costs over the next 10 months. Trials of the Sikuliak in Lake Michigan are the next step. After that, the university will officially accept the ship on behalf of the National Science Foundation. An onboard open house is scheduled for November on the Potomac River as the Sikuliak continues trials in the Atlantic and begins a long trip to the Arctic through the Panama Canal. The state has intervened in a case on the side of a man convicted of attempted murder, kidnapping, and assault of the mother of his children. At issue is the authority of a tribal court over a non-tribal member and tribal court procedures. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Edward Parks is a member of the Native Village of Stevens in Interior, Alaska. The mother and child in the case are members of the nearby Native Village of Minto. Parks had assaulted the mother of his children several times when the Minto Tribal Court terminated his parental rights. Following its own procedures, the tribal court didn't allow his attorney to make oral arguments. Attorney General Michael Garrity says the Superior Court found in Parks' favor in an appeal of the Minto Court ruling, and the state has intervened on his side as the case goes before the Alaska Supreme Court. Garrity says it would be different if Parks were a member of the Minto tribe.
If the tribal court, over which you have no control and don't vote in the tribal council and don't live in the community, is trying to exercise jurisdiction over you, that's another thing. If you have an attorney that you'd like to appear and speak on your behalf and he's not permitted to by the tribal court, I mean, I think that's another issue as well.
Garrity says the state is not asking that Parks' parental rights be restored, rather that the case not be allowed to set a precedent for tribal courts making decisions about non-members.
I don't get focused on Mr. Parks per se. Those are the circumstances he got his just he will get his just desserts when he's sentenced, and I'm not saying he's a good parent, or that the tribe should restore his, or that he should be restored his rights as a parent by the trial court or anybody else or by the tribal court. It's an issue over whether there was jurisdiction over him.
Natalie Singh is general counsel for the Tanana Chiefs Conference, the regional tribal entity for Interior Alaska.
Even though I shouldn't be shocked, I continue to be shocked that they could voluntarily participate to represent the interests of a man who they convicted for attempted murder.
As for the Minto Tribal Court's authority, Singh says under the Indian Child Welfare Act, tribal courts do have jurisdiction in just these circumstances.
The tribe's position is that they have jurisdiction of the child. If it's a member child or if the child is eligible for membership, the tribe has jurisdiction. And it doesn't matter who the parents are.
Under the Indian Civil Rights Act, tribal courts are required to provide due process or fair, unbiased procedures, but they can base them on their own laws and customs, such as the use of therapeutic and peacemaking techniques, rather than adversarial court procedures involving attorneys. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a ceremony on the beach in Homer to celebrate Alaska tribes.
One of the things was to celebrate, share, trade, and to, you know, have a good time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The interior is coming off what's likely to be a flat tourism season. Official numbers are not in yet, but Fairbanks Convention and Visitor Bureau President and CEO Deb Hickok doesn't expect anything surprising.
If we had a bump, it was just a tiny bump and nothing to write home about. So I would say essentially flat.
Hickok says a trend of declining long-haul road traffic likely continued with more people flying north for Alaska travel. She points to this summer's hot, sunny weather as a plus, but adds the season suffered a late start.
I know all of us can't think back that far, but it was a very cold May. And operationally, for example, for a riverboat tour, we actually had new ice forming on the river, which was unprecedented, I think. But then I think we regrouped in June, July, and August, September. People are still coming.
Looking ahead, Hickok says winter tourism continues to grow in Fairbanks. She cites recognition in the past year by Lonely Planet, National Geographic, and the LA Times with helping pump up interest. Hickok says Japan Airlines a major conduit for winter visitors as a robust draft schedule for the upcoming season. As the summer tourism season wraps up, interior operators are already looking to next year and worrying how they'll deal with a move by a major industry player. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Westmark's owner, Holland America Line, is permanently closing its hotels in Tok and Beaver Creek in the Yukon. An owner of a motel in Tok says her business may benefit by gaining customers that would have checked in at the Westmark, but, says Diane Young, a co-owner of Young's Motel, the Westmark's closure is going to hurt the community's tourism-dependent economy.
I mean, it's going to impact Tok a lot because that whole hotel complex is closing. That's a big business for our small community.
Holland America officials say the two hotels won't be needed to accommodate the tourists that the company's buses bring because, starting next season, Holland America won't be busing tourists from Fairbanks to Dawson City and back. Instead, they'll travel by air. Company spokesman Eric Elviard says that'll enable tourists to spend more time in Fairbanks and Dawson and less time on the road.
So what used to be a two-day motor coach drive, Fairbanks to Tok and then Tok to Dawson City or the other direction, is now about a two-hour flight with transfer.
Young believes Holland America made the change in part due to the often marginal condition of the rugged Taylor Highway that runs from Tetlin Junction to Dawson City. But Elviard says his company's decision was based on customer feedback.
We were getting back a lot of research and answers from folks about wanting to spend more time in destination.
Elviard says the change will affect 21 tours around the state. Holland America will use buses next year to transport tourists on some tours between Fairbanks and Denali National Park that had previously used the Alaska Railroad. The company announced that plan earlier this summer as part of its efforts to get tourists to their destinations more quickly. For KUAC in Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Two emergency dispatch centers in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough are one too many, according to findings of a study released to the Borough Assembly at its last meeting. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, a plan to consolidate Palmer and Wasilla's 911 emergency call centers is gaining favor in the borough, although critics say the merger will only hamper state law enforcement capabilities.
If you dial 911 from a cell phone within the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, your call goes to the Palmer Dispatch Center. Dispatchers there determine the location of the caller, then reroute the call to Wasilla if necessary. It's the rerouting that is causing problems within the system, according to Joe Blatchka with Bothell, Washington-based ADCOM Engineering.
Consolidating can address all of these issues. There's a pretty significant improvement in call processing time and call processing flow if you were to consolidate.
Blatchka's company recently presented a draft feasibility study on consolidating the two dispatch centers within the borough at a special meeting of the Borough Assembly and the City Councils of Palmer, Wasilla, and Houston. Blatchka said there is a framework in state law that allows consolidation. That task will take 5 to 7 months, construction or renovation of a new building, and a hike in phone surcharges within the borough. Dave Maganet, also with ADCOM, said the two systems are performing the same functions. They both use the computer-aided dispatch system, or CAD, the primary tool for tracking and handling incidents, but the CADs are not communicating with each other.
Some 911 callers basically have to tell their story twice in order to get assistance because of the way calls are routed. There is a potential for uncoordinated responses, and this occurs when emergency medical might be dispatched to a location where law enforcement has also been dispatched. But because they're dispatched by two different agencies, there's the potential that they may not know each other are responding.
Maganet says nationwide, the most common 911 call is a domestic violence call. If a domestic violence call comes into Palmer from an unincorporated area, it would be transferred to Wasilla to determine if law enforcement or medical help is needed. If EMS is needed, the call is then rerouted back to Palmer. The bouncing back and forth forces the caller to tell his or her story multiple times, delaying response time and confusing the record keeping.
The higher call volume due to the population increases was a big driver, we think, for change. That's going to get even trickier because, of course, the areas of growth are in those unincorporated areas, which, you'll remember, are being dispatched by somebody different than the folks who are dispatching EMS.
But the Alaska State Troopers say the consolidation could hurt statewide law enforcement efforts. Matthew Levesque, a deputy director at the Alaska State Troopers, told the group that the Department of Public Safety would prefer to have a number of dispatch centers in small communities to better serve outlying areas.
We just don't see a way that we can integrate because there is no model that supports it, and it would seem to harm our ability to serve all of the citizens of the state.
Other aspects of the study recommend a reduction in dispatch staffing. Maganet says the borough spends about $3.5 million annually to provide emergency services. He says the consolidation would not necessarily save the borough money. In fact, it may cost more, but the service level to the public and to emergency responders would be higher. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The Juneau Douglas Crimson Bears and North Pole Patriots football teams are playing in the medium schools football division this year. The two used to compete against Alaska's largest high schools. Now they're part of the small Southeast Conference. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander takes a look at the move.
Touchdown, Juneau Douglas. The Crimson Bears had no trouble beating the North Pole Patriots last week, their toughest conference opponent this season. Both have played in the Cook Inlet and Rail Belt Leagues for large schools. Now they compete in the Southeast Conference against Ketchikan, Sitka, and Juneau's Thunder Mountain.
There's not many conferences left, so we're kind of making the rounds through all of them.
Head coach Rich Soros has seen JDHS enrollment fall from a high school with nearly 1,800 students to less than 700. North Pole High School near Fairbanks also has a dwindling enrollment. Coach Richard Hennert says it's down to about 740 students this fall.
And ultimately it came down to the fact that OSTA has a cutoff and we're below that cutoff.
In 2011, the Alaska School Activities Association added a third football division for schools with enrollments of 326 to 800 students. ASA is the sanctioning organization for athletics and other activities. State Championship Director Isaiah Freeman says three divisions help small schools compete, like Barrow, Eielson, Valdez, or Seward.
A lot of the smaller schools could never, ever beat the medium schools. Just like the medium schools have a harder time beating like the Bartlett and Chugiak and Diamond, that was kind of the reasoning behind the division, so that those smaller schools had a shot at winning a state championship.
For years, Juneau and North Pole competed at the top of the large schools division. They made the state playoffs several times. JDHS won the championship twice in the last decade. And both football teams opted to stay in the Rail Belt for the first two seasons after their size shrunk. Now it's hard for JDHS and North Pole to compete with the large schools from Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Mat-Su. Where once there were 70 to 80 Crimson Bears, 47 boys signed up this season, says Coach Soros. There is little depth.
We kind of knew this was coming when we built two schools. You know, the numbers were going to decrease and something was going to have to happen and money was going to get tighter and that kind of stuff. And so I think we're making the most of it.
While North Pole still has a lot of kids going out for football, Coach Hennert calls the move to the SEC realistic.
Pretty much one out of every three boys that goes to North Pole High School plays football. We get a lot of bodies out. Whereas West Anchorage, you know, they have so many kids, it's probably one out of every 10 to 15 boys plays football, but it's the biggest boys in school that play football.
He says moving to the conference was a tough issue for coaches and players.
You never want to play down, so to speak. Those that are competitive want to step up to challenges.
Both coaches Soros and Hennert believe Juneau and North Pole can help make the small Southeast Conference stronger.
And we hopefully can be advocates in the conference here and maybe help them out and find ways to make football better in Alaska.
And Coach Soros says the medium schools division, with the Northern Lights and Southeast Conferences, may be the one to watch this season. But in the Southeast, Sitka has decided not to play JDHS and North Pole. That leaves only four SEC teams and 8 weeks in the regular season. So the two stronger teams have scheduled games against some of Alaska's tougher squads from other conferences. JDHS players say they're comfortable in the SEC, especially since the schedule does offer them more competition. And the motto this year, says running back Demetrius Campos, is the same as when they played the big schools.
State championship. That's the ultimate goal.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Every 2 years, a special ceremony is held on the beach in Homer to celebrate the heritage of Alaska tribes living in the region. KBBI's Peter Shepard attended this year as the final installment of our series, Looking at Culture in Alaska.
On a gray and drizzly Saturday morning near the end of the Homer Spit, they began to arrive in kayaks and one umiak, all of them gathering at the site of the Tamomptika Turalata kayak landing ceremony for a crowd of nearly 50 attendees.
A big boat whale.
Since 1997, this ceremony has been held on this beach every 2 years to celebrate the traditions and heritage of Alaska Native tribes living in the Kenai Peninsula region, with the first one attracting nearly 500 attendees. Tamomptika Turalata is one of many similar gatherings around the state. It takes place over 2 days, starting with a reception at Homer's Pratt Museum the evening before the landing, welcoming everyone who has made the journey to be in attendance. Allison Warden is a Inupiat Eskimo and was the MC for the event, along with being a first-time attendee. She says gatherings such as these are meant to encourage unity amongst the tribes.
For thousands of years, we've been gathering like this, and I think one of the things was to celebrate, share, trade, and to, you know, have a good time.
With noon approaching, more kayaks make their landing. To reduce the suspense, some in attendance even started an impromptu rendition of Lady Gaga. As the three kayaks and one umiak touched down on the beach, a blessing was given.
Blessed is our God, always now, never unto ages of ages. Amen. Oh,
Lord. Save our people, help us on inheritance.
Once everyone had safely landed, those in attendance were formally welcomed by McKibben Jakinski, whose extended family has called Nedilchik home for decades.
Long before there were cell phones, or phones of any kind, or the Sterling Highway, there was the water, and still is. And that was what connected us. So to even arrive safely is a blessing in itself, and where our family's roots come from.
Up next was a performance from Anchorage-based dance group Europic, which director Valerie Snow introduced to the crowd.
Paka. Paka means hello. Paka.
Paka.
Very friendly crowd. One more time, though. Paka.
Paka.
You're done. Oh, that's awesome.
Before the ceremony was finished, those in attendance stayed to watch brief performances from the Nanwalek seal dancers, the Port Graham Alutiiq dancers, and the Kanaitse Jabalina dancers. The Pratt Museum later hosted a reception for Tamamta Kachurulata with music, dance, storytelling, and a potluck of salmon, halibut, and seal meat. Homer residents were treated to more music, dance, and Alaskan Native culture at the Mariner Theater later that night, along with an exhibition from the Native Youth Olympics. Despite the attendance numbers having dropped from previous years, organizers of the event say this gathering plays an important role in the community. In Homer, with assistance from Aaron Selbig, I'm Peter Shepherd.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Borough, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Peter Shepherd in Homer. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.